Hello and welcome to Resettled, the ECDC ACC podcast. My name is David Combs and I'm your producer and host. This month's episode is sponsored by Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we're grateful for their sponsorship. This month, I spoke with Dr. Waqar Yudin about the Rohingya people with a special focus on the Rohingya refugee crisis. Dr. Waqar Yudin is a Rohingya American born in Arkhan, Rakhine State in Burma. He completed his undergraduate education in Burma, his MS from the University of Nevada, and PhD from the University of Georgia. He is currently a professor at the Pennsylvania State University. In addition, he's the Director General of the Arkhan Rohingya Union, the founding chairman of the Burmese Rohingya Association of North America, and a Supreme Council member of the Muslim World League. Leading the Arkhan Rohingya Union, representing 61 Rohingya organizations worldwide, Dr. Yudin's mission is to seek a political solution to the crisis faced by the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Dr. Yudin has led the international advocacy for the political and human rights of the Rohingya people in Myanmar at the United Nations General Assembly, Security Council, Human Rights Council, OIC Council of Foreign Ministers, and legislative and government bodies in several countries. Dr. Yudin has been working with the U.S. Department of State for over a decade on Rohingya issues. He has testified at hearings on the Rohingya issues at the U.S. Congress, Canadian Parliament, British Parliament, OIC Council of Foreign Ministers, and the OIC Ministerial Contact Group. Dr. Yudin has received OIC International Leadership Awards in 2019 for excellence in leadership working with the Gambia's Justice Minister in the International Court of Justice on the Rohingya genocide case, which is currently advancing. We're honored to have him this month. This month, we're discussing the Rohingya people and the persecution they suffer. At this point, most members of the audience have no doubt heard about the Rohingya crisis, but today we aim to provide you with a serious understanding of the Rohingya people, the nature of the crisis, and the challenges they face. Dr. Yudin, I'd like to begin this episode by asking you to first help our audience understand a little bit, who are the Rohingya people?
Rohingya people are actually an ethnic minority group, indigenous, native to Rakhine State, Arkhan, we are known as Arkhan, in the western Burma, western part of the country. Their history in Arkhan dates back to several centuries, way prior to Burmese invasion of Arkhan Kingdom. There was a Kingdom of Arkhan, separate country, was invaded by Burmese Kumbang Dynasty in 1785, and they took over. Basically, Kingdom of Arkhan invaded, and then they renamed it. The invader has renamed it as a Rakhine, which is now known as today as a Rakhine state. So these are indigenous population of the Rakhine, Arkhan, prior to the invasion of Burmese of the Kingdom of Arkhan in 1785. So you can see that they are there before Burma was there.
Thank you. So the Rohingya people have suffered terrible atrocities at the hands of the government of Myanmar over the last number of years. And I imagine most people in our audience, that's probably the best way that they can think about it. That's what they know. And we're going to talk more about that in a minute. But first, can you help us understand some of the origins of the conflict between the government of Myanmar and the Rohingya people?
That's a very interesting question. You know, actually, there's no conflict, to be honest with you, between Rohingya and Myanmar government is one-sided. One-sided persecution, one-sided atrocities, like World War II Germany. There was no between, the victims and the Hitler, right? So this is the same thing. It's no conflict between. Rohingya people were not the party in the conflict. They are victims. Of the government of Burma and Myanmar. Actually, there was a coup in 1962, military coup, just like this one happened about 3-4 months ago in February. There was a coup in 1962 that overthrew the military. The military overthrew the government of the democratically elected government of Myanmar. Then the junta started they started the blueprint of genocidal campaign against Rohingya people, solely based on nationalist ideology of the military. the ideology of nationalist, ideology of purity of race and religion, Burmese race, Bama race, and the religion of their Buddhist extremist religion. Extremist segment of Buddhist religion, although Buddhist religion is a peaceful religion, but there's an extremist segment to it, and that's what they started. The military has hijacked the peaceful Buddhist religion, actually. And Bama race also the main ethnic group, majority ethnic group in Burma, known as Bama, they are also peaceful people. And religion is peaceful. The military has hijacked it to advance its nationalist agenda and has started the persecution against Rohingya ethnic groups and also other faiths. You know, let's not forget they are doing persecution by Christians in the eastern and northern countries, states, and but the Rohingya atrocity is much more severe because Rohingya people are not resisting with armed groups. You go to northern Burma, eastern Burma, where China border, there's Kachin, Kayin. They are well equipped with arms, so they are not really Turkey. That Burma is shooting like Rohingya. Rohingya is a Turkey shooting for Burmese. So that's why it is much more atrocity is much more widespread because there's no resistance in Rohingya. So Christian groups in the east and the north are well organized and well armed. So they defend themselves. So atrocity is not as widespread. But the same ideology of eliminating anything which is not Buddhist, extremist Buddhists, or Burma, which military is used as a tool. Again, let me tell you, Burma people, I went to college in Burma. My roommates were Burma Buddhists. Peaceful people, very nice people, peaceful people. But military just hijacked their religion and their race.
Now, would it be fair to say, and if I misstate, please let me know, that in a sense, because of this conflict, or this one-sided conflict, shall we say, for many decades now, the Rohingya people have in some ways been somewhat stateless. That is, their home country rejects them as citizens, and neighboring countries view them as refugees, immigrants, et cetera. But in a sense, they're caught between a home country that doesn't want them necessarily, and neighbors who view them as outsiders, immigrants, people who they would kind of like to send back.
Yeah, stateless. You just mentioned statelessness. Statelessness is used a lot at the international stage about Rohingya, but actually, it's a little bit complicated. The statelessness is actually it does not quite fit with Rohingya crisis. I'll tell you why. Rohingya people have a state, and they have their country. They have their land, native land. They have been victim, target of extermination from their own land. And they are citizens of Burma like any other ethnic group of Burma. So genocidal campaign was started to revoke their citizenship. And then that's have paved the way for elimination of the population, aiming at expulsion to neighboring countries, to Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and Gulf states, and many countries, about at least 10 dozen countries, they have been. So it was easy task for Burmese military, just push them out. The people will try to save their lives and run. Bangladesh has more because it's a neighboring country. Now you can see the population is also in India. You see a lot in Malaysia. It's people going through across the ocean, going to with the boat, you know. Pakistan has 500,000 Rohingya. Pakistan has. And Saudi Arabia has about 350,000 people. So they are scattered all over the map, basically. A violent assault in Rohingya has resulted that there was a series of sequences of violent attacks on Rohingya civilian population by Burmese military. There's one in 1979 called Nagaming Operation, Operation King Dragon, they name it, to eliminate Rohingya. In 1992, 2012, and 2017, the latest one that you have seen, And that's why Rohingya has to flee to safety to other countries, not just Bangladesh, anywhere they can find safety. That's why I mentioned about at least a dozen countries.
That's a really important point. I'm glad you made it. Now, speaking of
let me just step back. So those countries, you mentioned one thing, and they are not wanted. You know, Rohingya people are not those countries. For example, Bangladesh, an overpopulated country, meager resources. Bangladesh is not equipped to take additional burden of population, where it is struggling with its own population of heavily populated. Some other countries like that. So they are very sympathetic to Rohingya. They have hosted a lot of Rohingya, but who will want somebody leaving their lands? It's not that they do not want them. Host countries want them to go back to their country of Burma and reclaim their rights. If people keep coming and Burmese encourage people keep coming to other countries, but it will encourage Burmese government to expel more, to drive out more, because they know it's going to work. So this country has been very, very generous to Rohingya people. That you know, they are, it's not that they are not wanted, but strategically, they wanted them to go back and reclaim their rights. And this country has an economical impact also.
Well, I think that's a really important nuance, and I'm really glad that you mentioned it. Now, in a previous discussion, you and I talked about in the early 1980s, Myanmar implemented a citizenship law, and that ends up being very important in this overall conversation and the overall narrative arc of what exactly it is that's going on. Can you tell listeners about the citizenship law and the implications for the Rohingya people?
It's 1982 citizenship law. It is widely known as the Black Law. It was drafted and enacted by the military dictatorship. They used to have a socialist communist type, some kind of institution. They used to call it a parliament. You know, how can a dictatorship have a parliament? They have their Politburo type parliament. So they will pass that citizenship law. And that they drafted and passed it, and that has voided the existing citizenship law. They were drafted and in effect since 1947. That's called 1947 Constitution. They voided that and replaced that 1947 Constitution, the citizenship law according to that Constitution, and 1982 citizenship law. The military's law, the citizenship law, has three categories of citizens, namely citizen, associate citizen, and naturalized citizen. That is the person belonging to an indigenous race. Okay, indigenous race, that's defined by indigenous race, or children of the indigenous race, or lived in British colonial period. Rohingya ethnic group is an indigenous race. That's why they are trying to, Burmese government's military is defying that Rohingya are not indigenous race. They don't want to recognize the Rohingya as indigenous race, because that brings us to entitlement of our regaining of our citizenship. That's what three. So all the class one, class two, class three, okay. So Rohingya were class one before, but they have been revoked. And then with this all the tricks and the games they played to exclude them, 1823, prior to 1823, blah, blah, blah. Not 1823, Rohingya are before 1823, before 1785, Rohingya were there, before in Burma came. So then class two is the citizens of, those who acquired citizenship through 1948 Union Citizenship Law. It's just basically, and third one is naturalized citizen. So class two is a kind of naturalized citizen. It's associate citizen, they call it. And third one is naturalized citizen. That is those who lived in Burma before January 4, 1948. And that's applied to citizenship law after 1982. So they are three classes. So they try to put Rohingya now in class three. They were scrutinizing when they will be qualified to get class three. You know, they are just trying to exclude the population. So there's a cleverly drafted. This 1980 Refugee Citizenship Law was basically targeting Rohingya people, believe it or not. They say, oh, we have five countries, different borders. We are surrounded with five different countries. We have to have a full national interest. We have to have this law. They are actually basically targeting Rohingya, how to eliminate them. So they have revoked the citizenship, and now they are genocide. They are expulsion. You know, these are all the sequential events.
So in a sense, this law has imposed, at least on paper, this is kind of where the stuck between status, in a sense, of the Rohingya people comes from. This is sort of where this, and you said earlier that the statelessness is sort of an awkward terminology for it, but this is kind of where it comes from, because the Rohingya people had lived there in the area before the borders were even drawn. So how do people who defend the Myanmar government, how do they defend themselves and the government on these particular points?
People who are defending Myanmar government does not know the history or the background of the Rohingya people. Myanmar government has a fake, you know, manufactured narrative that these people are illegal immigrants from such and such country. And those people who do not understand and Rohingya and the Arkan, Kingdom of Arkan, Burmese invasion, people who are living there before the Burmese invasion of Arkan and taking over, that's why they are defending, but they need to be educated.
So while the Rohingya people have suffered persecution for decades, the experience that that probably most listeners, I would imagine, are most familiar with is the crisis that erupted in the year 2017. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances that triggered that massive movement of Rohingya people out of Myanmar and into Bangladesh?
Okay, yeah. This is the major event, catastrophic event. In August 2017, military claiming that a local armed group, okay, those thugs or something, you know, every community has thugs, you know, homemade weapons, you know, spears, machetes, swords. So there's a group known as ARSA. Okay, so Myanmar government has attacked that the ARSA group, local armed group, a small tiny group. Some people call them bandits. Attacked the police outpost. You know what? The interesting thing is that Myanmar government said 25 policemen were killed, attacked by this group. That could not be independently verified. There's no picture of it. There's no police victims. There's no name of the policeman. There's nothing about them. Simply said that 25 policemen were killed. So there's no way to verify. It's just it could be a propaganda, highly likely to be a propaganda to just set off this sequence of events. It's created by the military. So this was put out by the media, and a lot of people believed it without knowing the facts, without show us the proof. I asked the military, show us the proof. You're 25 policemen were killed. You said, show us the proof. So they cannot come up. So on that pretext, the military has assaulted the Rohingya villages, saying that, oh, we need to do ground clearance. And these groups are everywhere in the Rohingya villages. Over 420 villages have been reduced to ash, burned down completely because they are eliminating. They call it ground clearance. So they say, oh, we're saying ground clearance to clear the insurgents, this ARSA group, the bandits. No, you are ground clearance means you are clearing the population. Just tell what it is. No need to tell lies. So the brutal assault has caused Rohingya villagers to flee, you know, because they have been burning village after villages. When people are running away, running to their safety, believe it or not, children, women, men, they've been shot at. Is that ground clearance? You're shooting at the civilian population, which is escaping the assault and burning villages, burning homes. You're shooting at them. and then raping women, gang rapes, grabbed the children from mother's lap and threw in the fire, locked up people inside their homes, locked up and set the home on fire, torched their home. So these are ground clearance of the population, not ground clearance of the insurgent groups, bandits. Due to the intensity of the horror and atrocities, over 750,000 people has to flee from Rakhine State. And where do they go? They cross the border. They find where the safety is. That's Bangladesh next door. There was a Thailand next door. They would have gone to Thailand. The India was close enough. They didn't go to India. They will go where people will take shelter, where the safety is. They can find safety. So this was pre-planned by military months before. The pre-calculation that the village can be quickly eliminated through massive attacks on the village residents. That's what they did. Now all those villages are completely flattened, become barren field. They have military has bulldozed the villages, not just burned, making flat open ground now. There's no removing any trees, no trees, nothing left. So this is what really has happened, triggered the refugee influx to Bangladesh, massive population movement of 750,000 people plus, over 750,000 people in August 2017.
So you mentioned Bangladesh as being the closest area for safety for the Rohingya people. Fleeing to Bangladesh from Myanmar takes a lot of forms. Can you tell listeners about the dangers faced by those Rohingya people who are fleeing from Myanmar? Because when I asked this, I took a look at a map, and it seems to the uneducated viewer, and I'll call myself among the uneducated viewer, at a glance, it looks like a very short distance to travel. But reports that I've read suggest this could take days or weeks to make what seems like a very short journey. Can you talk about the challenges and the complexities that they're facing as they try to escape, what that looks like?
Yes. The route of escape to Bangladesh involves terrains, rivers, creeks, barren fields, different kind of terrains. And they could be 10 miles, 20 miles, 15 miles. That distance is not an issue. The issue is the rugged terrain and on foot. Where you are escaping, fleeing your village, burning, and then they have their whatever belonging they may have on their shoulder, on their back, you know, and babies holding them, little kids, elderly people cannot walk. So 10 miles is going to be 100 miles, you know, so how difficult it's going to be. There's numerous dangers they faced during when they fled. First, they were shot at. There's one danger. They were shot at by the Burmese army, military, and as they were leaving their homes. And they went through rice fields, open fields, rugged terrains, forests. So all on foot, along with children, elderly, and sick and wounded people. Sometimes dead bodies they have to carry. They cannot leave the body there who were shot at. And then have to cross the river, water. And there's, is a boat there or not? Is there a vessel to cross? That's another problem. Some of them have to swim. Some of them cannot swim. Some of them have drowned. They've been being chased. So depending on the location of the village, food travel was maybe 10 miles, 30 to 30 miles, 40 miles. And not only Maungda Township, there's also Budhidaon Township. Sometimes it took one day, sometimes it took three, 4 days, several days. There are pictures of you see surfacing on the internet that children floating in the water, dead bodies, they're drowning. They're rickety boats, wooden boats, overloaded. They'll grab something boat and they try to cross, it sank. So these are the horror they went through. Many of them have died. Dehydration, hunger, illness, weakness through illness, they're so weak to walk, they were rampant. It is horrifying. I've seen some videos. I've seen some videos. It's horrifying. No human should go through this, regardless of their religion, race, ethnicity, nationality. They are all human, but they have to go through that. But they found the safety. Thousands of people were lost. Thousands of people were lost.
Now, as people make their way from Myanmar to Bangladesh, it seems, if I understand it properly, and correct me if I'm wrong, the refugee camp just across the border at Cox's Bazar has become the largest refugee camp in the world. Can you tell listeners about how many Rohingya people are hosted in this camp?
There are several camps, the size of the camps vary. The one you're referring to, I think, is called Kutu Palong. That's the world's most crowded refugee camp. At the density of 40,000 people per square kilometer. One square kilometer is 0.4 square miles. 0.4 square miles, 40,000 people are cramped. You can see their condition. You can imagine their condition. This monsoon rain, food, disease, summer heat, and natural disaster, and food shortages. Water availability during summertime, during monsoon time, flooding. So this is 40,000 people in 0.4, less than half a square mile.
And if I remember the raw number, so you're talking about 40,000 people per square mile, but there's somewhere on the order of 720,000 people across in the entirety of the sort of the multiple camps. Is that number about right?
Yes, 750,000. It increased. Then it was 750,000. How many years we have? 4 years, 5 years? Their children born. Their kids are growing up. So there are some people came later also. So in 4 years, children being born, you can see it's going to be close to a million easily. And they are, just don't forget, they are pre-existing refugees. They were came to Bangladesh in previous attacked by military to villagers. They are pre-existing about 400,000 people there already before August 2017. So there are altogether over 1.2 million, at least.
So really, when I say refugee camp, that's a pretty poor choice of words, actually. This is a city, and actually kind of a large city.
Yes, large. You can call it a large city. You can call it a large slum. Like a slum is because of tents, rickety wooden tents, bamboo tents, a plastic cover, roofing, plastic sheets they put, and the water flowing into these tents. So this is a city, if not like building cities, city of slum city. This is a horrible places, and bamboo, made of bamboos, leaves and plastic tarps and so on and so forth. It's a very hazardous place, and the fire hazards. And some camps were burned down because of this this material, bamboo and leaves and thatches, they're made of these camps.
Can you talk a little bit about the experience of the Rohingya people in the camps? What kind of, probably almost no infrastructure, but can you talk about the kind of infrastructure, sanitation, things of that sort? What is the experience of a person who's living there?
It's just like a floating community. There's no infrastructure. These are tents. These are slum, and they're on the hillside. Some of them are on the hillside. Some of them are on the foothills. Some of them are on the flat floodplains. There are limited food and medical supplies. A place like concentrated people, place like that, of nearly over 1.2 million people, new refugees and previous refugees, older refugees. Children are going without education. They found us in the book. 4 years ago, a child who was 10 years old or 14 years old now, teenager, where's the book? Where's the education? Where is their future? And so these children are going without education. And there's disease outbreak, cholera, all different kind of disease outbreak. due to sanitation issue, limited water wells, and of course there's no electricity. These are the conditions that refugees are living under.
So the people who are living in these very, very difficult conditions, how are they living in the camp day to day? And can you tell the audience, what is their overall outlook on the situation? How are they feeling?
Oh, people are passing their days in agonies, hoping, they are still hoping to return to their home countries, homeland, home villages, their homes. Remember, although their villages have been flattened, they said they can rebuild. They can make the tent, like a refugee camp, on their property. And from that tent, they can grow. They can rebuild their lives. They want to go back. I've spoke to many, many, many refugees. Not a one single refugee said, we're going to stay here. Okay, we want to go back. But the outlook is not really that great. Outlook is gloomy for them because of delay and this military coup and then military attacking Rohingya, ethnicity, and all negative things coming out of the government. Although the government of Burma has signed agreement with Bangladesh, including with China. They're called tripartite agreement for repatriation. But nothing is happening today. So people are losing hope. They feel no purpose in their life with lingering helplessness and hopelessness. So the outlook is, we cannot be discouraged. Outlook is not good, gloomy. People are losing hope, but we encourage them, look, stay steadfast. Keep your optimism high. Keep your determination, strong determination, that you one day you will be going back to where you belong, to your country, to your archon.
I've seen reports that have suggested as the camp has grown, there's a number of security concerns for the residents. Can you shed some light on the kinds of security issues they might face while they're living in? I keep calling it a camp, but the city, the slum city, as the case may be. Can you talk a little bit about the security conditions that they're enduring?
Yeah, absolutely. There are growing security concerns as some people in the camps and slum city are becoming desperate. And there are sources or institution groups. No sources, no institution, no groups to guide them and mentor them to this rapidly growing generation. Young kids are growing, as I said earlier, 4 years old, a 10-year-old kid is and a 14, 15-year-old now. The older ones are older. So there are no infrastructure. There's no resources available for them to guide them with education, to teach them what is wrong, what is right. They're out of desperation. These are not violent people, but there will be naturally some kind of elements will come out, bad elements, because and also to information we receive, there are bad elements from outside have come into the refugees and then this dominating them. There's some small armed groups, the small armed groups, bandits will come and then rob them, ask for money, and then try to dominate them, lure them into doing crimes. So this is the situation.
While the Rohingya people have been very clearly rejected by the military government of Myanmar, how have they been received by other governments? Because you mentioned a few minutes ago that there's Rohingya people all over and so many countries in the region. How are the other governments responding to them? Is it with a general kindness? Is it with welcome? And I'm sure it's an oversimplification to say that, but how are they being responded to, and how are local populations and governments receiving them?
As I said earlier, the government, the host countries are very generous, very sympathetic to Rohingya. On the other hand, it is a burden for them, for country Bangladesh. They have limited resources. So under that condition, they are taking care of the refugees. Given under the circumstances, the government and people of Bangladesh have taken care of them very, very well so far. It is a challenge for them to take care of such a huge refugee population of over 1.2 million people that started from 1979, 1992, 2012, 2017. There are influxes, major influxes, four or five times major ones. These are all, remember, these are not gradually coming in. These are sudden influx, all of a sudden, you know, coming in 700,000 people. So how Bangladesh is going to handle this? You know, we salute Bangladesh for that. And we're able to host, accept those people. Once people arrived in Bangladesh, very little death, you know, unless they are sick from their journey and they are saved. All these people are saved. All people who are killed were in Burma side, where army has shot at, burn their villages, burn their homes, you know. So mass killing, the crime. And the host country, it was not prepared for it. Bangladesh was not prepared for it. They did not know all of a sudden 750,000 people, nearly a million people were coming in a matter of 1 to 2 weeks. So that's why only good thing was that international community stepped in very quickly. Really, international humanitarian relief groups work with government in Bangladesh, and help came very quickly. So that's how they were able to save the people from starvation and diseases and other things.
I've been reading some articles about the government of Bangladesh trying to move some Rohingya people to islands in the Indian Ocean. Can you talk a little bit about that or comment on it? It was just something that I saw that I was a bit confused by.
Yeah. This island is off the coast of Bangladesh. It's called Bashanchar Island. So some refugees were moved there. Bangladesh government has moved. The reason was that what we heard, there was that overcrowding in the camps in Cox Bazar. They're overcrowding, as we talked about overcrowding earlier. There were concerns, though. Although Bangladesh government may have their own reason, there were concerns about the safety of the refugees on the island that sits on the general path of cyclone, you know, tropical cyclone. Normally, this is a path. It goes through alley, cyclone alley. It appears that moving of refugees to the island slowed down. There are reports of refugee very few people want to go back there and wanted to be moved. And recently, I saw a report from Dhaka, Bangladesh media that people who were moved, some of them escaped. They went there. They thought there's going to be something that they would like to live temporarily until they go back to Burma. But they probably did not find that is the place for them. So they have been escaping, they have been arrested, been made. So there's a bit of complications now.
I see. Over the last year, of course, the entire world has struggled with the COVID-19 pandemic. How has it affected the Rohingya people, not only in Cox's Bazar, but in other places as well?
Yeah, fortunately, COVID-19 did not hit. At that time, the refugee community, as we all feared at the beginning of the global pandemic, very nervous that one person gets sick in this overcrowded refugee camp. You think about it. Fortunately, they were spared by the COVID, by the grace of God. Only a few people have died. Only a few dozens, maybe I would say less than 100 have died from the COVID. And generally, Rohingya community in many other places were not affected widely in the refugee camps, beside those affected spots where people died. And some people recovered, some people died, but generally it was not what we really feared during the pandemic.
Well, that's a tremendously fortunate thing. Overall, what strikes me about the experience of the Rohingya people is that they seem to be rejected by their home government. We talked about that. And it's not that necessarily other governments are actively rejecting them, but they have their own challenges that they have to deal with. So it feels like there's this group of people that are, for lack of a better word, this isn't quite true, but without a country in a sense, at least one that wants them. And so I wonder,
What does this do to the psyche of the Rohingya people to not necessarily feel as though someone wants them? I can't imagine what that would feel like if my home government didn't want me. What does this do to a people's psyche, and how does it impact how they feel about their place in the world?
You know, their home government, you know, like them because of, again, good example of World War II, Germany, right? So this is unfortunate. These people are helpless. Rohingya people are helpless. Nonetheless, people who are taking refuge in the region in South and Southeast Asian countries, South Asian and Southeast Asian countries, want to go back to their homeland, right, in Myanmar. But government of Myanmar is constantly putting a stumbling blocks, making it difficult for them to return, you know, one thing or the other, delay, delay, delay. Most of these countries in the region are hosting the refugees. As we spoke earlier, limited resources to support them. Therefore, it has become a significant economic burden for many, some of the countries. Also, another reason that this government may not want Rohingya, a lot of Rohingya, keep coming to their countries because that is becoming a pull factor. Once people, a boatload of people come to Malaysia, and Malaysia government accept them, another boatload will come. So it's a pull factor. People are seeing that they have been accepted. So at the end, there will be no refugees left, no Rohingya left in our country. People will be moving out because Myanmar government is also looking that. Military is looking that the people are being pulled by the other countries. So they will do more atrocities. So people will leave because government, military knows that they can go somewhere. Like Malaysia, Indonesia. So there's another pull factor. There are very concerns. There will be more influx coming. So the government of Myanmar is looking for that kind of opportunity too. So there's a catch-22, you know. Either way, you cannot win. There's a problem. There's a dilemma, big dilemma.
In February of this year, Myanmar experienced another coup in which the military deposed the democratically elected government of the nation. How does this coup, in your estimation, impact the near future for the Rohingya people?
At this point, it is difficult to predict how it will turn out for Rohingya people. Currently, Myanmar military is so much engaged in fighting with its own people, its own race, not forget about Rohingya. There are countries in big turbulence and instability. It is not only fighting with its own ethnic group, Bama, the majority group, it also fighting with various ethnic groups. There's a bloodbath going on in Burma. So therefore, Rohingya issue has not been adequately handled by the military junta. They are very busy with fighting with their own people now. Right after the coup, military junta wrote a letter to the government of Bangladesh. The day they did the coup, that they will say in them and to Bangladesh government that it will repatriate Rohingya refugees in Myanmar. So we don't know why they were sincere or not, but nothing has happened yet.
The name of this show is Resettled. In many ways, the idea of the show and the reason why we run it is to highlight the stories of people who have been resettled out of difficult situations and the people who work in the area of resettlement. Yet the Rohingya people are almost permanently unsettled, which sort of is a strange thing given the nature of the show. So with that notion of resettlement in mind, what do you suppose is in your thinking the path forward for the Rohingya people? Do you suspect that the current state of affairs, a massive refugee crisis with people being permanently in a state of limbo, is likely to continue? Or do you think that there's a path forward, a true permanent settlement in a way, for the Rohingya people to return to Myanmar and live in safety and security?
Rohingya refugee crisis is a lingering issue. We all know that. With the largest influx into the region in 2017, there's significantly two large refugee crises also took place earlier in 79 and 1992. In both earlier cases, and during those cases, in 1979 and 1992, there were repatriations actually, believe it or not. Although they did not repatriate all of them, but significant number of people were repatriated during those influx. Now Myanmar has signed, as I said earlier, a tripartite agreement with Bangladesh and China for repatriation of Rohingya refugees. since China, a big supporter of Burma, is involved in this repatriation agreement. We're hoping that repatriation will likely going to take place, but the question is how soon. Is China going to be active in this agreement that he has signed? Is going to be China is going to put pressure on Myanmar to take people. China is part of the signatory on this agreement. So it's up to China, which has mediated the agreement, and up to Myanmar to comply with the agreement. So we'll have to wait and see. There's always hope. We are not giving the, our people are not going to be giving up the hope, because it is our land, it's our country, it is our Rohingya peoples of Arakan. So they will, they have to go back one day, sooner or later.
So there's any number of potential solutions that could be brought to bear to help the Rohingya people. But if asked, what would the Rohingya people say? I mean, I shudder to ask you to speak for everyone, but what solution do the Rohingya people most want?
Actually, the solution that Rohingya people want is simple. It's not complicated. That is turning the clock back to before 1962, when the Rohingya people had all their rights and treated equally by the democratically elected government of Burma, like any other citizen and of the country. So before 1962, Rohingya were the ethnic group that had full citizenship like anybody else, that had rights with all the rights until 1962. And after 62 military coup, they have been revoked. So we want that back, as simple as that, with rights, citizenship, and safety and security. The problem can be solved once the government of Myanmar reinstates their full citizenship, just turning the clock back. Reinstate their full citizenship like it was on ethnic-based Rohingya, and give their all basic rights and security. And the socioeconomic issues in the long term, you know, people will have to live, and it comes slowly. Once they have their security, once they have their citizenship back, once they have their rights, and they can build themselves, and the socioeconomic issue will be addressed gradually. And then come peaceful coexistence. There are other fellow citizens, other ethnic groups, and we have lived peacefully with them. We can live peacefully again all together as a citizen of Myanmar. This is what the people want. Just a simple thing that is making complicated by Myanmar government and Myanmar military.
So I want to be mindful of our time, and I know we're coming towards the end, but as a final question, if our listeners would like to help the Rohingya people, even in small ways, do you have any recommendations for what they might be able to do?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. Your listeners, your audience can do a lot of things. That is doable. First, I will give you some example. First, the American public, the listeners, may want to reach out to their elected officials in Washington to continue to work with the Biden administration to officially determine the genocide, Rohingya genocide, which will be an added value to the Rohingya genocide determination case in the International Court of Justice. This is going to be a long-term solution. It is going to be a permanent solution. This is going to have severe impact because Myanmar government is being held accountable at the International Court of Justice. So we need official support from the US government. They are supporting us officially now, but there has to be one step further, need to go. Determination of once the US government said, okay, this Rohingya crisis, a genocide. And that will have a lot of added value to the ICJ court case. In the US, there is limited public awareness on the Rohingya issue. You know, there are a lot of people know, but there are still limited awareness. So the listeners can reach out to the local and national news media and advocate for more and regular coverage on Rohingya issues that you do not see a lot. Sometimes you see CNN at the bottom, you know, there's a writing comes up, you know. Occasionally you see the story, but not widespread. Other channels the same. So on the Rohingya issue, increased coverage on Rohingya issue issue. Not just when there's a crisis. You see, that's the difference. There's a peak of crisis, they will cover it, and then they'll subside. No, it has to be a kind of like a stable, constant coverage that what is going on, not just responding to the spike of violence against Rohingya people. More engagement on social media on the issue, that will be a great resource of information for the public. Social media, you can get all the information, you know. So the engagement, everybody engaged in that, media and others, activists and others, and people who are knowledgeable about the Rohingya issue. I have seen a lot of my friends, American friends, and my colleagues, and they have engaged. They are engaged in social media about Rohingya issue. The spreading what is Rohingya crisis about is about. Rohingya issue is an ongoing problem that should be kept in high profile at the international stage. Myanmar government also looked, military also looked, that it will subside, they will do more atrocities. They is quiet down. So that's why we need to keep that profile high, as it is. Interfaith groups in US is very powerful also. And in many locations, the community have deep interest. Interfaith community has deep interest in helping Rohingya in many ways, with tremendous sympathy. And let's not forget, there are nearly 500,000 internally displaced Rohingya in inside Rakhine State. We talked a lot about in Bangladesh, Malaysia, Indonesia, and other countries, but there are a significant number of refugees, we call it IDP, internally displaced person, camps inside their state. Their houses were burned, homes were burned, villages were burned. They have nowhere to go, so they are in camps. Very little humanitarian relief is reaching to those IDP camps, 11 of them in Rakhine State, due to the limited international relief groups working there. So they are limited international relief groups. They need to be increased. Despite that, they need to be increased. Their activity needs to be increased. That's why we can do a lot from here, U.S. Citizens, American public, and international community can do. Despite the challenges in dealing with Myanmar government, the international relief organization must step up in their efforts to increase their presence in the Rohingya IDP camps in Myanmar. This is very important because they have been hidden there, back there. Nobody knew about them. There have been a lot of crises there. So that's going to be very important. International agencies, there are a lot of international agencies there. Your listeners, audience can reach out to U.S. government agencies. And there are U.S. government agencies. They are already working. Some of the agencies are working, but there are other agencies can get involved. And Red Cross, UN, United Nations groups, agencies, and the very other private organizations. To demand greater presence in Rakhine State, Arka. So there are very limited presence, international organizations there. So that's what the audience can demand, our government and other institutions, UN and others, US public, your audience can demand us. That will be big help to this cause.
Dr. Udine, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an honor speaking with you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me to speak on Rohingya issue.